Hello, and welcome to episode number 78 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. While the modern UFO era may have begun with the emergence of saucer sightings in the early to mid-20th century, that picture eventually grew to include not only those initial sightings, but also reported interactions with the supposed beings piloting these sophisticated, non-conventional craft. Yes, indeed, aliens, or as they're often called in modern ufology circles, non-human intelligences, often to clarify that we don't actually know where they're from, just that they're not human. At least we're pretty sure of that fact, if by human we mean beings akin to contemporary Homo sapiens sapiens. Of course, as we'll see in today's episode, that clear-cut distinction between us and them might not be so easy to delineate after all. But we'll get to that. From sightings of supposed alien beings, or apparently non-human but very often humanoid beings, the picture filled out even more, to include the now infamous abduction phenomenon, where modern Earth humans are taken aboard craft, often from the comfort and quiet of their bedrooms in the middle of the night, where they are then subjected to a wide variety of experiences, including, in some cases of a perhaps less apparently positive nature, invasive medical procedures and supposed hybridization programs, and in more apparently positive reports, opportunities to see the cosmos and even, on occasion, to learn to maneuver the craft, often via mental intention alone, no less. In terms of the beings often seen, while there really is a broad spectrum of others, one particular form has come to represent the quintessential alien in our cultural zeitgeist. Here I speak of the proverbial gray alien. The emergence of this particular form had much to do, one could argue, with the front cover of Whitley Strieber's groundbreaking and nerve-rattling book, Communion, published in 1987. Of course, that image wouldn't have made the waves it did if it were not for the fact that many thousands of people reportedly recognized that prototypical face, sometimes much to their chagrin. After all, if they recognized the image, it was somehow familiar to them, even if murkily so. Did this mean they too were perhaps alien abductees? These were chilling questions for a plethora of human beings to contemplate. Of course, the fact that these beings were, if not exactly human-looking, then certainly humanoid, raised many questions. Why would an alien being look so much like us? Wouldn't the evolutionary trajectory of their own planet have taken them in very different directions? The conventional thinking on these matters assumed this would be the case, and it's partly this that led to so much ridicule and scoff. Many took these humanoid forms as a good reason to ignore the entire affair altogether. It's as if these people decided that since aliens wouldn't look like this, the entire affair must be reducible to make-believe or delusion. And yet, the enigma of this particular form of otherness has endured, to the point where it's now a mainstay in our cultural heritage, both for those who believe and don't believe aliens are here and are actually interacting with human beings on an ongoing basis. Of course, another possibility that's emerged more recently, and this would explain why these others look so much like us, is that they actually may be us, but us from the future, our descendants, who have been taken in some strange evolutionary directions based on future events. So what is it? Are grays from an extraplanetary source, i.e. are they extraterrestrials, or are they future humans, what Michael Masters has aptly deemed extratempestrials? Or is it perhaps that both options exist? And furthermore, could the prevalence of this form and its evident ongoing connection to us point towards an even deeper and more primary construct that might not only speak to common origins, but perhaps also to a common terminus, maybe in the form of the singularity that rushes to meet us at the end of time? These are the perplexing yet fascinating ideas we'll endeavor to explore in this, the 78th episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. I call this episode the quintessential other because this form, the gray alien form, really has taken on an iconic role in our contemporary culture. Almost everyone in the West is familiar with the typical features of this humanoid but so-called alien form. You can see it on bumper stickers on cars regularly. You can get t-shirts, mugs like this. Simply put, the gray alien form is part of pop culture. This is what Wikipedia says of the gray alien. Quote, gray aliens, also referred to as Zeta Reticulans, Roswell Grays, or Grays as in spelled A-Y instead of E-Y, are purported extraterrestrial beings. They are frequent subjects of close encounters and alien abduction claims. The details of such claims vary widely, but typically grays are described as being human-like with small bodies with smooth gray-colored skin, enlarged hairless heads, and large black eyes. The Barney and Betty Hill abduction claim, which purportedly took place in New Hampshire in 1961, popularized gray aliens. Precursor figures have been described in science fiction, and similar descriptions appeared in early accounts of the 1948 Aztec UFO hoax and later accounts of the 1947 Roswell UFO incident. The gray alien has emerged as an archetypal image of an intelligent non-human creature and extraterrestrial life in general, as well as an iconic trope of popular culture in the age of space exploration, unquote. Indeed, because this form, this figure, the gray alien figure, is so common in pop culture, it may be hard for some people to take it seriously. Because it's been mocked and ridiculed for so long, almost like a comedic trope, it's going to be hard for some people to recognize that these beings are real and actually interacting with people. And yet all the evidence in the world suggests that's exactly what's going on and has been going on. Though even in that description in Wikipedia, you'll notice they brought up Betty and Barney Hill. And there have been some people who suggested they may have seen some images of science fiction aliens beforehand and then used that kind of description to describe what they saw or maybe didn't see for those who are really skeptical. And eventually this took hold and became part of our cultural fabric, if you will. I think this is far too cynical, far too skeptical. These beings are real, and people have been interacting with them for decades and decades, if not for centuries or longer. And again, the fact that they can control our consciousness, control our perception, largely makes it possible for them to carry on this sort of double agent scheme, where on the one hand, they're well known within our popular culture, and yet many, many people assume it's not really happening, they're not really real, they're not really abducting people, and yet that happens. But again, we have to toggle back and forth between the ones that are perceived positively and those that are perceived negatively, as well as somewhere in between, because you really do get the full range here. For some, this form, the gray alien form, strikes fear into hearts. For others, it is a warm, familiar feeling of being reminded of a friend or even family. We've discussed before people like Susie Hansen, who actually consider themselves part gray. In her Dual Soul Connection book, she mentions how basically when she's with them, she has a gray identity that comes online and a human identity when she's in the everyday world that we live in. We're going to learn about someone else today who also has a similar kind of account. And again, it goes back decades. And again, just like Susie Hansen, it began with fear, but later became more like a relationship and a very close relationship where trust was central. Now, in the introduction, I mentioned the Communion cover, Whitley Strieber's famous book, probably his most famous book, his first book about alien abduction, abductions that were happening to him. And this was before this was part of our cultural fabric, of course. This really was a groundbreaking book because it made it part of our cultural heritage. Now, gray aliens are humanoid, like I said in the introduction, and that alone is somewhat surprising based on evolutionary expectations. We really need to highlight this here because those of us who are intimately familiar with this topic by now are so familiar with these humanoid-looking figures, whether they're gray aliens or Nordics or the tall whites or what have you, we see these beings that are regularly humanoid. Even the reptilians are kind of a cross between a lizard or a reptile and a human being, still very humanoid. So what is the deal with that? That's not really what you would expect. That's not what we were taught in biology class growing up. We were taught the expectation that a different planet would produce very different looking life because they would likely have very different conditions on that planet. And it's the conditions of the planet, of the environment, that shape the evolutionary trajectory of the life there. So why would they look so much like us? That alone is a very, very curious item, perhaps one of the most curious. And we'll look into in depth what that might mean in today's episode. Now, as I said, there are numerous groups of grays. I don't think it's just that some people have positive accounts, some people have negative accounts, and you can really reduce that to their personality or whether or not they're a fearful person or not. There are some people of the love and light crowd who want to believe that all alien encounters are positive, and if they're reported as negative, then it's just that people haven't got past their own fear. They're projecting their fear, basically, on positive, peaceful entities. I think that does a disservice to people. I think I've interacted with people who are telling the truth. They're giving a very accurate account. Of course, subjective interpretation is always part of the mix in any event a human being is involved in. And yet I don't think we can deny the fact that across the board, there are both positive and negative encounters beyond just interpretation. Now, yes, some begin as shocking and later become spiritually transformative and positive. That's one kind. But there are other kinds that involve invasive medical procedures and things like that that really stay in the negative category, I think, or at least self-serving. I think that's the way we should look at this, that these beings cover the gamut of moral development. Now, that might be confusing to some people because they say, well, if they're just a gray alien, one type, why would there be so much divergence in terms of their moral development? Well, for one, we can see a lot of that even with human beings at any given point in time, including here in the 21st century. Another thing I would say here to interject into the conversation is that when you read the raw material, for instance, there are fourth density entities, entities that are beyond us in terms of evolution. They've dimensionally shifted beyond 3D, which is kind of the state that we're in. And these beings are both positive and negative, or serving others, or serving the all, and serving themselves. So you still have that divergence there in terms of some beings that are still kind of power players looking to dominate others, playing that zero-sum game, while others are more non-dual in their perspective, and they're seeking to help. And I think that partly explains what we're seeing here. I think that's a good depiction of what we see. It lines up well, that even with one form, this gray alien, you get some that are very benevolent, non-dual in realization, and helping human beings, others that either are self-serving or have kind of a symbiotic relationship, but are still ultimately in it for themselves and playing the power game. And I think some of these ones are the ones that have made accords with various human governments, or maybe even governments that are kind of shadow governments, in order to dominate the human population. Again, not trying to instill fear there. I think there's plenty of good ones. And I think the most benevolent ones are the most advanced, the most dimensionally shifted, dimensionally advanced along the spectrum of consciousness development. What else can we say of these gray aliens? Well, another thing to make note of is that they're almost always telepathic. And this is true of both the ones that are seen as benevolent and those that are seen as more malevolent or less mature, shall we say. Now, of course, we all are familiar with the large wraparound almond-shaped eyes. These are often described as oily black and are known to have a hypnotic effect on people. Now, the benevolent ones are known to go out of their way to communicate in ways humans will understand, waving and sometimes even forming the semblance of a smile, even though this is usually not part of their normal behavior. Considering, again, they are fully telepathic with each other, they don't use things like facial expressions and speech, for that matter, actual speech by moving their mouths much anymore. Now, in that Wikipedia article I quoted from, you'll notice that these are often known as Zetas, and that's because there is this belief that they come from Zeta Reticuli. Now, both the good and the bad, or the mature and less mature is maybe a better way to put that, groups are known to exist and are known to come from that part of the cosmos. Now, often people who have had encounters with one have a hard time imagining the other. Again, this is where human bias comes in. In other words, if you're someone who's had extremely benevolent encounters with these beings, that this form represents everything love and light, goodness to you, incarnate, it's very hard for you to imagine that someone could have a negative experience with them. Try to imagine Santa Claus, for instance, and someone says to you, negative Santa Claus comes down the chimney for me and it's never good. You have a hard time imagining that because you've always seen him as this jolly elf who brings gifts. You get the point. And of course, the opposite is also true as well. And of course, it's important to point out that there are also those kinds that people have interactions with that are kind of a middle-of-the-road kind of moral trajectory. In other words, they seem a lot like us. Business-like, perhaps. They have a job to do, but they're not necessarily seen as evil or good, benevolent or malevolent, just here to do a job, so to speak, even if sometimes they're a bit business-like and arm's length in terms of their interaction with us. They don't seem very emotional sometimes, is what's reported, even when they're not outright negative. Now, speaking of the ones that are seen as negative and really do include some negative elements, these encounters often involve mind control and an animal or commodity-like treatment of human beings. Again, we see this in the so-called alien abduction phenomenon. This phenomenon often involves invasive medical procedures. Procedures that really could be conducted in a different way that would involve less pain, you would think. Sometimes the aliens, the grays that are interacting with human beings and actually performing these medical procedures, sometimes seem more frustrated by the human being screaming and making noise than they are with the fact that the human being is expressing the fact that they're in some degree of pain. Now again, I'm not saying there aren't benevolent ones that go out of their way to make us feel comfortable, but there are also these negative encounters in which human comfort doesn't seem to be very much of a high priority. Now, speaking of abduction accounts involving these gray alien forms, these gray alien types, these are often multi-generational. Now, parents feel particularly helpless in these cases when they are seen as negative or not very positive. It's a helpless feeling for these parents when they cannot stop this from happening to their children, knowing what they went through. Now, these often involve various apparent hybridization programs, as I mentioned in the introduction. Now, what's strange about these is sometimes even there'll be these strange bonding rituals that are requested by these grays, or basically, it's almost like a force thing, where a human being is abducted and then asked to hold one of these hybrid babies that look something like half human, half gray. And they hold them for maybe 10 minutes, half an hour, and then they're taken back on the craft and the human being is returned to Earth. Sometimes that hybrid might be taken to a different planet, they're told, or somewhere else in the galaxy. But again, you have to ask yourself, what did that half hour or an hour really do in terms of bonding? Is this because they awkwardly don't really understand human bonding, and this is just a really superficial way of trying to sort of just check that off the list? Oh yeah, bonding, we had to do that. That's what human beings do. So we'll do that for half an hour so we can say we've done it. Or is it that there's more than meets the eye here? That this is more of a psychological ploy, doing something in our deep subconscious that we don't really understand. In other words, the bonding ritual is kind of a ruse for something else that's going on. Now, in terms of these hybridization programs, of course, this begs a whole series of new questions. Why would they be hybridizing with human beings? How can they hybridize with human beings? Again, we're back to this question of not only do they have a human form that's so similar to us, but apparently they seem to be genetically compatible with us in some way, which you could argue suggests a common background in terms of DNA heritage. Now, some might suggest that with their advanced technology, they've just found ways to get beyond that, that they can actually make compatible two kinds of species that weren't beforehand. But this at least begs the question, why are these hybridization programs going on, and how are they even possible? Now again, there's been a few suggestions in terms of why they're going on. One idea is that they just like to play games. They like to experiment with different kinds of species. And so this is part of a game to them, to take two different forms, put them together, and see what comes out. Another possibility is that they're highly advanced and they're actually populating different planets with new life forms, that they are basically the progenitors of these different species, these different civilizations. The origins of these different civilizations owe their beginnings to these beings, and perhaps they are hybridizing with us and then are going to use this to start some new planetary civilization. Another possibility, of course, is that perhaps some of them have an impoverished genetic pool. They have come into a kind of a dead end where they need some genetic variants in order to inject new life, new vitality into their genetic pool. And perhaps they have found that human beings are compatible in a way that serves this purpose. Indeed, to this end, I'll have you know that some very interesting letters were uncovered that were written in the 20th century, written to various government figures within the United States government, basically making this claim that it was known by some elements of the U.S. government that an ET species had come here needing our genetic variants to remedy some sort of malady in their genetic heritage that had gone wrong, and that some human governments had actually agreed to let this happen under their watch, basically the abduction of citizens and the taking of various genetic materials in exchange for technology, for instance. That's one of not only the stories that came out, but I've actually seen letters written, credible letters written, that are now in various archives that speak to this very kind of event. And of course, speaking of different notions of why this hybridization would be going on, I would be remiss to not mention theories like that put forward by Dr. David Jacobs, suggesting this hybridization program is a nefarious kind of affair where ultimately they want to take over planet Earth. And they are slowly injecting their DNA into ours to turn us into kind of zombie humans that will be basically passive when they eventually take over. Or in another scenario, we have part of them in us, our future descendants do anyway. So there really isn't any kind of fight or even argument when they eventually come and take over because we are effectively them as well. So either fully gray alien or half and half or something like that, some sort of hybrid form alien and human that has basically been bred to be well adapted, well adjusted to the notion of this takeover by this alien species in the future. Of course, by then the notion is so many of us would be zombie humans or these kind of alien-human hybrids that there wouldn't be much of a fuss at all when the takeover actually happened. Needless to say, I'm sure it's not surprising to you. I don't put a lot of stock in that kind of notion, but I would be remiss to not at least bring it to your attention. One other notion put forward to explain why this hybridization will be going on, and not just the hybridization, but also the gathering of genetic material, is because they are concerned that we will blow ourselves up, that we are on the precipice of self-destruction, and perhaps, according to some experiencer accounts, they claim they've even seen other species get to this point and basically self-destruct. So, on the one hand, they're trying to help us behind the scenes to prevent that from happening, but in case they're not able to prevent it and we do end up self-destructing, they want to have our DNA on tap, basically, so they can reproduce us somewhere else if necessary, because they recognize the value of human DNA, of life in general, and kind of like scientists on an expedition, they want to hold on to that material in case they need to repopulate us so we don't completely get wiped off the cosmic scene if we do self-destruct here on planet Earth. One final reason I'll put forward in terms of why this hybridization might be happening is because perhaps they are setting up a series of ambassadorships, that they want a group of ambassadors, basically, half human, half alien, that can help some sort of transition, not necessarily a nefarious transition in terms of them taking over, but maybe because they're going to become more public, they will expose themselves to us in a mass way. It'll become part of public knowledge that they're here. And to aid in that transition, to reduce the shock, the idea is there will be human beings that are basically hybrids across the planet that can help navigate this transition. It also should be pointed out here that these ambassadors, these hybrid human alien types, would also be able to help with communication, not just in terms of aliens communicating with us, but with us communicating with them. In other words, by having half alien, half human DNA or something like that, they understand both species to some degree, and this helps with the communication process. You can think of Spock on Star Trek, who is half Vulcan, half human, and seemed to understand both groups to some degree because of this, even though sometimes as a character, he was kind of torn by this dual nature. I would also point out that I really do believe evidence suggests these beings already exist, these hybrids, and some of them are walking amongst us. And part of the reason why I believe that's the case, and you're not seeing them necessarily and saying, that looks an awful lot like something like a cross between a gray and a human, is because often they look fully human. Again, I think we have to remember that They are highly advanced technologically, and they can pull this off in a way that is kind of going to dupe us. We're not going to know the difference necessarily until it's time, and then they can be revealed. Again, it's not so much about the form here as it is about the shared understanding, the bridge between the two different sides in terms of communication, if indeed this is what these ambassadors are for, if these hybrids are actually ambassadors. And I'll just remind you that people like Susie Hansen have spoken in this way about her own ability to communicate between both sides. And she suggested this is the mission she has, to basically be an ambassador when some sort of massive transition happens in the future. Again, we talked about that recently in the Cataclysm episode. Now, interestingly, Susie Hansen is not the only person saying these kinds of things. In fact, right in her home Australia, New Zealand kind of area, there is another person named Judy Carroll who has a very similar story about initially being shocked by having encounters with what she realized were aliens, and then later realizing these were very benevolent, very non-dual realized beings who were here to help, and that she even realized that she had some sort of connection to them, and even that she, like Susie Hansen, had kind of a dual nature, half gray, half human. And when you read her book, The Zeta Message, again, because she believes they are from Zeta Reticuli, that's what she says they have told her, she believes they are basically non-dual realized beings, fully benevolent, siblings in cosmic consciousness, if you will, here to help us and here to help us make the transition from a technologically sophisticated species who is on the brink of self-destruction because of our technological prowess that has not seen an equivalent increase in consciousness capacity navigate these tricky waters in our history. So that covers some of the main points within the extraterrestrial aspect of this conversation. But of course, as I hinted at in the introduction, there's another possibility here. And this has been gaining steam, you might say. Now, Professor Michael Masters says that these beings, these gray aliens, when he looks at them, and when he thinks about them as an evolutionary biologist, more importantly, he claims they are almost certainly related to us. He also believes that the future human hypothesis is more parsimonious, takes less of a stretch. You don't have to include aliens in the picture. All you need is time travel. And we already believe hypothetically, theoretically even, that time travel is possible. We already have ways we can think about that. In other words, practically, pragmatically, it's logical to assume that if time travel is theoretically possible, and leading theorists believe it basically is, there are some who don't, but generally, there's growing consensus that it is part of the picture, that space-time is one fabric. When you warp it enough, you can both travel in time and space. So if that's the case, then it's logical to assume that eventually, assuming we don't blow ourselves up anytime soon, that our descendants will develop the capacity to travel in time. And based on our history, you can almost guarantee that if we can do it, we will do it. And what Michael Masters is saying is that when you look at gray aliens, what we see is evidence plainly in front of us that this is us from the future, come back to do something. The question is what? Are they here on some sort of scientific expedition to just study their ancient ancestors in a up close and personal way? Or are they here to change something in the timeline, to prevent something from happening, or to ensure something is going to happen? I already talked about in previous episodes, and we touched on it again last time in the Cataclysm episode, that part of the intel that I found from various sources suggests that there are notions in the intelligence communities suggesting that there are more than one faction of these future humans here, and that they are here in relation to some sort of cataclysm that's coming in the not very distant future. I won't go into this in detail because I've already discussed it elsewhere. Again, if you didn't hear last time's episode, I'd go back and listen to that, episode 77, where I discuss this in more detail. And even in previous episodes, I did 3 episodes in a row covering this time-traveling future human hypothesis. Again, Masters calls these extratempestrials because they're not extraterrestrial. They're not beyond the Earth. They're beyond time, our time, hence extratempestrial. Now, of course, that also means they're from elsewhere because the Earth is going to be in a different place, a different location in space in the future. Nevertheless, extratempestrial focuses on this time aspect. And we just want to make this really clear. Masters is an evolutionary biologist. This is his specialty. He has a specialization in the hominid line. And interestingly, even he says, when he saw the front cover of Communion all those years ago when he was a kid, he immediately thought that being must be related to us in some way. As it turns out, he went on and got a PhD in this very field so he could study it. Again, you might ask yourself, that's kind of an interesting coincidence that he went into that. What's that all about? Maybe we'll hear more from him in the future about that. But nevertheless, it's put him in a prime position to look at this, look at the evidence in an objective way based on a specialization in this specific kind of study. And he's saying that when he looks at them, considers their different aspects, they almost certainly are related to us. And furthermore, based on the current trajectory of the evolutionary line of human beings, he says if you just follow that out a few thousand years, you will end up with something that looks a lot like a gray alien. And that's without any kind of major event happening in the future, that the larger head, the larger eyes, the more childlike features, those kinds of things are already something that we're evolving towards. So it's not a stretch in his mind that we would eventually look like gray aliens. And again, from his point of view, the humanoid thing you can't get past. They look so much like humans because they actually are humans, just humans further along the evolutionary trajectory. Now, we already discussed why the ETs might be here and why they may be doing this hybridization. But what if these are actually extratempestrials? Why would they be doing this? Why would they be conducting hybridization programs and gathering genetic material? We already talked about they're possibly here in relation to this timeline and the cataclysm issue. But taken apart from that, we need to reckon with the fact that genetic material is being gathered. And if these beings are actually extratempestrials, you ask yourself why. And one of the main arguments has been that they somehow end up in a genetically impoverished condition. Again, kind of like the ETs we talked about, where they actually are lacking genetic variants and they're suffering birth defects, basically, like what you have in inbreeding, because there just aren't enough of them and not enough variants to ensure a healthy stock. So the only way they can remedy that malady is to come back in time and find beings that are compatible with them because they're their ancestors who have been lost to the arc of time. But because there's more variants in our time, they're able to come back, take genetic material, inject it back into future populations, and to remedy these maladies. That assumes some sort of, again, genetic impoverishment, some sort of disease-like issue that's been brought into the genetic stock. But there are other possibilities too. Some people have talked about the fact that they may have, or we may have in the future, basically bred emotion out of us, that this was actually something we aimed to do at some point, but then later regretted it. Perhaps we realized that, like Spock, you kind of need a bit of human and a bit of Vulcan to really make wise decisions. You don't want to lose emotional intelligence, and perhaps that's what we did. So one of the arguments, one of the even accounts put forward by experiencers is that these beings say they've lost the ability to be emotional and they've suffered because of it, not just individually, but as a collective. So by coming back and taking some of our stock, they're hoping to inject that element back into their own future. So again, it's interesting how much overlap there is here in terms of the accounts provided by experiencers based on what they've been told by these other beings. Now, one thing I would point out to you here is that part of the account we hear from intelligence circles is that these extratempestrials, these beings from the future who look like gray aliens, but are actually just neo-humans, future humans, want us to believe they're extraterrestrials because they don't want to interfere with our timeline by us knowing they are future humans, that somehow they will do less damage to the timeline, be less interventionary by letting us believe they are space aliens from Zeta Reticuli or somewhere else when really they are just our descendants. Now, I'll leave it up to you to decide how compelling that argument is, but that's not only what some people have suggested, but that's even what intelligence sources have suggested. They were told by these extratempestrials that they are actually us from the future, but they let the public believe they are space aliens, so they cause less damage to the timeline, at least potentially. That is one story anyway. And now I'd like to offer you a few other kind of ideas to consider that might make sense of the fact that these are humanoid beings that look very human in some ways, even if not precisely human. One possibility involves ancient common seeding. The idea here is that there was a cosmic seeding program and evolutionary divergence has happened based on circumstance and different planetary factors. In other words, what if you originally had the seeding of one sort of base level kind of being, and then based on the environmental conditions of whatever planet they were planted on, they developed slightly differently. So you still get a humanoid form, but you get some divergence because of different environmental conditions, presumably on different planets. That's another possibility that would make sense of why we see so much common humanoid characteristics. Another possibility that's very intriguing, speaking of time, involves an alternate Earth timeline. So what if these actually are beings not from our future, but from our past, but that took a different evolutionary trajectory than us in an alternate Earth? That's certainly possible. All it would take is perhaps one more meteor hitting the Earth and, you know, blotting out the sun for a long period of time, where you would end up with beings, human beings, that looked different, that had that paler skin because there wasn't much sunlight, because it's being blocked out by the clouds. They would develop these huge eyes because they needed to draw as much light from the environment as they could, again, because it's darker, because perhaps this planet, Earth, has been covered by clouds. And perhaps because of various difficulties, they learned telepathy to a greater degree than we have, because of, again, different planetary conditions, even though the ultimate planet is the same one, Earth, just an alternate Earth in a different timeline. That's possible too. One other piece to bring to your attention is the notion of convergent evolution, which is defined like this. Quote, "Convergent evolution occurs when species occupy similar ecological niches and adapt in similar ways in response to similar selective pressures. Traits that arise through convergent evolution are referred to as analogous structures. They are contrasted with homologous structures, which have a common origin." Unquote. So the notion here is kind of counter to this common claim that we learned about in biology growing up, suggesting that likely alien life would look very different because they had different planetary conditions. But we know that actually there's constraints across the cosmos that might cause some very similar kinds of planets to form. So the notion here is, even if you had different planets in different parts of the galaxy, if there are enough common shaping elements in those environments, that you would end up with fewer and fewer idealized or optimized forms to emerge from that sort of evolutionary trajectory. So in other words, what you would end up with is, especially at the higher ends of the food chain, beings that looked very, very similar, even if they're from originally very different contexts. So this is the notion of convergent evolution, that they're converging towards the same kind of form because of similar pressures, even if they come from originally different environments. So that's another possibility as well. We would also be remiss to not at least consider the fact that these forms aren't their true forms. In fact, even some of the experiencers who encounter these grays, these zetas, will sometimes learn that this is just a kind of suit or form they took on that allows them to navigate in our kind of dense 3D plus one structure of reality, this construct. And also sometimes people are told they take on this form to make it easier on us, that they look like us, but different enough that it's shocking without being completely overwhelming, although some might disagree with that. But this is part of the notion too, that they take this form on for our sake so that we can see something physical, even though some of them are post-biological or even post-form. They basically are immaterial at this point, light forms basically, but they take on this form for our sake so they can communicate with us. Now there's one other possibility that would explain this common humanoid form that I would like to make you aware of. I actually think it's the most compelling argument based on the evidence I've seen and based on the material I've come across and what I've studied and my understanding of reality. I think this is the best fit. And this is also covered in the raw material. You've probably heard me mention this more and more. Again, I've said elsewhere that I think that's the best channeled material we've ever received. I think that it's good not just because I believe the people who channeled the material, but also because it lines up so well with other non-dual sources, the deepest spiritual traditions of our history as well. So I'm not putting all my eggs in that basket because I just happen to believe the people that say they channeled this extraterrestrial slash interdimensional source because I like them and I think they're trustworthy, but also because the material itself just seems very self-evident to me. I think it speaks to truths that actually exist. It corresponds to reality as I understand it. So in other words, the metaphysical architecture lines up with mine, not just based on my own studies and my own history, my own journeying, but also based on experiences I've had with other kinds of intelligences, lines up very, very much with this. And as I've said on other podcasts, I came across this raw material after I'd had my experiences with this contact with another kind of intelligence, and I was amazed by how much it lined up. And I had one of these sort of brightness experiences, is what I call them, something that kind of makes it clear to me I need to look in a certain direction. I get these kind of indications sometimes. And that's what happened when I came across this raw material. I had this kind of brightness effect that is hard to describe. It's kind of extrasensory, but it just says to me, you need to look in this direction. There's something here for you. So when I started reading the raw material, I was amazed by how much it lined up with the revelations I'd experienced and teachings I've come across over time. So in some ways, it is kind of the amalgamation or the summit of all the things I've ever learned. And that's one of the things about this phenomenon is sometimes as time goes on, you feel like it recontextualizes your entire history. That's been my case, where suddenly not just this year and the previous years and the previous decade, but all the decades of my life somehow take on a new meaning and a new kind of transcendence and a new trajectory based on this recontextualization that's all come about fairly recently through these revelatory kind of experiences. So that's another reason why I think the raw material is just really, really good and I trust it. But that said, the raw material speaks to this notion that in different parts of the cosmos, you kind of have this metaphysical seeding that happens. So the cosmic seeding part we talked about before, but it's not just a biological thing. It's actually a spiritual focus, a consciousness focus, which also has a physical element to it, or at least the illusory nature of the, kind of the physical. So we have kind of that non-dual kind of thinking here. But the idea is that a sublogoic kind of entity or intelligence seeds a part of the galaxy with certain kind of forms, common forms, and that these become part of the archetypal unconscious even of a species. So when you look at our unconscious and our collective unconscious that Carl Jung spoke a lot about, what you have is these kind of archetypal forms. They're basically like templates, these pre-made forms that are populated in certain parts of the cosmos that are then injected with kind of vitality. That is, the entire cosmos, the entire creation kind of emerges and evolves through these kind of different dimensional layers, that these templates are then filled with energetic resonance and become what look like physical beings. And so basically that would explain why you get something like a gray alien and a reptilian and a mantis being. Why do we have mantis beings look so much like these insects from our planet? Because again, there's these seeding templates or these archetypes, these starting forms that seeded into the very evolutionary and multidimensional development of a certain part of the creation. That's basically what we see happening here. So in this sense, I think this would explain well why we have these different kinds of entities, different beings, who I really do think are from different parts of our physical universe that actually share this common seeding. But again, the key here is to recognize this is a metaphysical kind of endeavor, that the physical element, the physical universe element that we see is, again, just a construct, just a derivative of some deeper structure. I've been talking about this a lot, that even physicists like Nima Arkani Hamed these days recognize that space-time is not a thing. He says it's doomed because he recognizes as a model, it's just not tenable. It can't make sense of what we know about what we see around us. There must be some deeper structure to reality from which you get the derivatives of quantum theory and space-time. And I'm saying this lines up with the raw material and the revelations I've had, that underlyingly you have this metaphysical kind of architecture, which has a derivative of what looks like the physical universe. All that is to say, in terms of what we talked about today, I actually think both are in play, extraterrestrial or slash interdimensional and extratempestrial, future humans. I think both are in play, and the common humanoid form is because of this underlying metaphysical architecture either way. But I actually think the best interpretation of the available evidence is that both exist, both are here, extraterrestrial slash interdimensional, as well as extratempestrials. But again, the common seeding form, this templating, this archetypal origin is what's key to all of it. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. And I do have future bonus episodes coming in just a couple weeks, specifically for patrons. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.